Second great borrowing, utilized a little later, was, of course, the printing press, initially invented in Korea and China, carried to Western Europe during the same late post-classical period and put to use by a variety of inventors, but particularly Gutenberg in 1450, right at the end of the period in question. It's always possible to look at the West at the end of the post-classical period at a point where the West is on the verge of beginning to assert a new and more active world role. It's always possible to look at internal developments in the West itself. Quite clearly, Western political capacities were beginning to improve in the last centuries of the post-classical era with the emergence of feudal monarchies. Very clearly, military rivalries in the West, the frequency of war, the frequency of feudal conflict or conflict among monarchies, helped spur the West's interest, particularly in technological developments, either imported or homegrown, that had military implications. Christian inspiration in the Crusades, or later in Spain and Portugal as they chased the Muslims out during the later stages of the post-classical period. Christian missionary inspiration might inspire the West to new levels of activity. And early facets of the Renaissance, presumably a new spirit in Western cultural affairs, might inspire new Western activity onward. There's no question that textbooks in Western civilization routinely assume that changes within the West in the later post-classical centuries leading to the Renaissance were the crucial determinants of later Western activity in the world as a whole. But a world historian, I think, can legitimately, and I don't think this is an anti-Western stance, take a slightly more cautious view. Possibly new opportunities for imitation and the results in terms of new world role actually came first and then helped inspire changes internally in the West that would amplify the Western tradition, that would build on it in ways that become familiar parts of the Western story.
Lecture 16, The Mongol Years.
We're talking in this session about an extraordinary period in world history that covers much of the 13th and 14th centuries, 100 to 150 years. This is a period that can be known now as the Mongol era or interlude in world history, and it had some decisive results for most of the societies in Europe and Asia, although the results differed from one case to the next. I can't think of a people that have been so reconstituted in the historical view as have been the Mongols in the last decade or so. When I took history, if the Mongols were mentioned at all, it was with a grimace and an apology because they were bloodthirsty barbarians who killed a lot of people to no purpose whatsoever. More recently, the Mongols can be seen as an unusually tolerant people who managed to establish a political system that facilitated interregional contact to a greater extent than had ever before been possible or would be possible for some time thereafter in world history, a decisive interlude in which the general theme of interregional contact was directly intensified and furthered in ways that, in broad outline, would survive the Mongol period itself, though we need to come back to this at the end of the discussion today. In 1999, The Economist magazine, a respectable, rather conservative British periodical, named Genghis Khan the Man of the Millennium, an extraordinary accolade. Think of all the other candidates. Now, this was probably partly due to his military achievements. Here was a nomadic leader who managed to defeat much of one of the great civilizations in history at the time, the Chinese. But it was really more a tribute to Genghis as the first of a succession of Mongol rulers who would manage to administer conquest reasonably wisely and who would use conquest deliberately to accelerate the contact among different kinds of people. Whether he deserves the honor or not, frankly, is immaterial. I think the notion of choosing the man or the person of a thousand-year span is a little silly. I would want at least three choices personally. But the revision is striking. The Mongols have now a revered place in world history, in contrast to the dustbin to which they'd been traditionally relegated. Probably, as in any revision, this one may have pressed a bit too far. The Mongols could be cruel. Genghis Khan could kill urban civilians in order to set examples to other cities so they would yield more quickly to his forces. After all, the Mongols did not have a terribly numerous army, and they needed to use devices of intimidation to bolster their chances of success. And undoubtedly, Mongol rulers subsequently were not only seen as disruptive and terrifying, but could be disruptive and terrifying. Certainly that was the widespread impression among Russians as Mongol invasions penetrated that society. So we don't need to whitewash the slate entirely. There are downsides to the Mongol experience. But, and here we may perhaps not pay sufficient attention to casualties and cruelties of the past, but the dominant revisionist picture does seem valid. This was an important episode in world history that furthered connections in ways that had durable results and, to some extent, began a process of reshuffling among major societies in ways that would have durable consequences as well. We don't know precisely why the Mongols decided to invade China. This was, in one sense, the last, and it was the last, of a series of eruptions from Central Asia, from the nomadic territories of Central Asia that had earlier seen groups like the Indo-Europeans, the Huns, pour out. Probably some combination of population pressure in a nomadic economy that was fairly fragile, and political rivalries, which were undoubtedly involved in the immediate environment of Genghis Khan, probably some combination encouraged the Mongols to look to the rich society to their east, and divisions in China itself. The Mongols had long been one of several border people who were harassing the Chinese and pressing into what was traditionally Chinese territory during the Song Dynasty, probably opportunities in terms of Chinese imperial decline encouraged the process as well. In any event, early in the 13th century, Genghis Khan did invade China and conquered a good bit of it, and the conquest was completed in ensuing decades so that his grandson, the great Kublai Khan, the Khan that Marco Polo encountered, if indeed he went to China, the great Kublai Khan was ruler of China entire. And this Mongol rule in China, known in Chinese as the Yuan Dynasty, this Mongol rule would last for the better part of the ensuing century. In China, the Mongols occupied a really interesting and distinctive position. They used the Chinese government system. They used Confucian values, and they used the Chinese bureaucracy, even though many bureaucrats resented them greatly. The Mongols were, once in power at least, tolerant. They saw the advantage of not overturning established systems. They didn't insist on identifying their own ways and ramming them down people's throats. The Mongols did, however, actually disapprove of many aspects of Chinese values. They found Chinese court life stultifying and continued to live in tents outside capital cities. They didn't like the Chinese gender system. Mongols were among the nomadic peoples, and nomads varied greatly in this regard. Mongols were among the nomadic peoples who gave women a considerable voice in political decision-making. The wife of Kublai Khan was instrumental in calming him down on occasion and urging that he adopt restraint toward Chinese traditions. But no question, the Mongols thought that foot-binding and the subjugation of women in the post-classical Chinese fashion was a bad thing. And the Chinese reciprocated by coming to detest the Mongols, with that kind of resentment that combines disdain for barbarian, unwashed peoples. I don't personally know Mongol bathing habits. The stereotype was probably pressed too far. But the combination of disdain for a people viewed as inferior who nevertheless had decisive power. And the Chinese would work assiduously to throw this new dynasty out, which they accomplished toward the end of the 14th century. But actually, Mongol rule in China itself brought clear economic benefits. Chinese manufacturing developed further. Chinese opportunities to trade with other parts of the world expanded. Indeed, the Mongols intensified the kind of Chinese relationship to the world network that we have seen developed earlier in the Song Dynasty prior to the Mongol incursion. In China also, the Mongols utilized, along with Chinese bureaucrats, a variety of foreign peoples. This was a regime that was deliberately hoping to open up the societies it ruled to a wider set of influences. So Christians from Western Europe were welcomed. Marco Polo and his uncles were presumably used in Mongol administration. They had learned the Mongol language earlier, though they never learned Chinese. People from Persia were widely used. Nestorian Christians, a Christian branch that had long since migrated out of the Middle East, were used and their places of worship newly tolerated. This was an interesting mix of successful adaptation of Chinese customs and a sort of welcome mat to peoples from other societies. And the net result, clearly, was trade benefits for China itself, even though this did not overcome Chinese hostility, and a new openness to China for peoples in a whole host of other places, including, of course, Western Europe itself. Mongol conquests soon surpassed the conquest of China. We've discussed earlier the importance of the Mongol invasion of the eastern part of the Middle East, where they conquered Baghdad and overthrew the last Arab caliphate. A Mongol Khanate was established in the eastern Middle East, including Persia, that held sway for several decades. Mongol Khanates fanned out in Central Asia, so for the first time, Central Asia became somewhat coherently politically organized. And the other great conquest of the Mongols involved Russia toward the end of the 13th century. Just as with the Middle East and the Mongol success in overturning the caliphate, where earlier Arab political divisions, increasingly unsuccessful efforts at caliphate rule, helped prepare a successful invasion. Well before the Mongol invasion of Russia, Russian rulers were having increasing difficulties with restive nobles. They were having problems maintaining the coherence of the Russian territory. So, as is so often the case in history, successful invasion in this instance combined with prior internal weakness. But the result was a tremendous Mongol sweep across European Russia, exempting only a very few territories, but interestingly stopping short of pressing beyond the boundaries of Eastern Europe, thus sparing Western Europe and creating a new kind of division between the Russian experience and that of most of the rest of Europe, a division between direct Mongol rule and a good bit of anxiety, but frankly, ultimate freedom from this kind of invading pressure. Mongol efforts also pressed into Southeast Asia at key points. There are no really durable conquests involved, but this was brought into the Mongol horizon to some degree. So by the late 13th century, in what is one of the most amazing sweep of successful invasions in world history, perhaps the most amazing, Mongol rule had established khanates, interlocking khanates tied by blood relations and cultural affiliations from China in the east all the way to Western Russia in the west, from northern China and Russia in the north to the Middle East and incursions into Southeast Asia in the south, a block of territory that simply had no precedent in world history. The results are familiar and important. It became increasingly easy to travel back and forth overland from west to east and east to west. European travelers were obviously particularly important. Popes began to send Christian emissaries to the Mongols quite early, with two purposes in mind initially. The biggest goal was defensive. Papal emissaries wanted to persuade the Mongols to stay out of Western Europe, to stay out of Catholic territory. But gradually, there emerged some hope that religious missions might convert some peoples in the Mongol realms, including in China, and make contacts with small Christian groups in these regions as well. Not a lot happened in that regard, but a number of papal emissaries went, and some increased knowledge of China resulted from these trips as well. The more famous trips, including, of course, the travels of the Polos, involved Western merchants, particularly from Italy, though there were French and others as well, Western merchants who went to the Mongol realms, taking advantage of the safe passage that the Khans could grant. You could enter one Khan territory and get a passage that would assure you favorable protection as you went onward. And although we know of only a few of these trips, and again, the Polos are particularly important, but there were trips by a few European Jews and others as well, the result actually uncovers a surprising number of Europeans who made it to China for one reason or another. There were European artists established in China, European entertainers, the opportunity to see a new place, possibly earn money in a new place, have a different kind of experience, was clearly widely stimulating. The consequences amplified, of course, the kinds of knowledge that exchanges had already been bringing to the world network. It was during this period that Europeans had a particularly clear opportunity to learn about Chinese technologies and to import some of them directly. They learned about some that they didn't take full advantage of. For example, Marco Polo describes the use of charcoal in smelting iron, the use of coal as well as charcoal in smelting iron, in ways that wouldn't be widely taken over in Europe for some time. But key Chinese developments, particularly printing and explosive powder, were crucial imports that passed west from the east at this point in time, and gradually would begin to create a process in which the huge traditional technology gap between East Asia and Western Europe would begin to be somewhat closed. That perhaps is one of the crucial long-term results of this process. Contacts also, as they accelerated in this period, had a downside. It was in the Mongol period that the Black Death began in China and spread quickly to the Middle East and Europe. The bubonic plague presumably, although there's some debate about this, bubonic plague presumably began in the Gobi Desert in western China, passed quickly into eastern China, and then because of the trade connections between China and other parts of the world, spread rapidly elsewhere. Bubonic plague began to be registered in Middle Eastern port cities by the middle of the 14th century and in Western European cities a couple of decades thereafter. In both these cases, death rates were appallingly high. Upwards of a quarter to a third of the population of Western Europe and the Middle East succumbed to the bubonic plague in a major population blow that would obviously have crucial effects on these societies thereafter. Interestingly, on balance, at least in the West European case, while the population blow was huge and had major dislocating effects in wage relationships, labor relationships, and major implications as well for religious retreat against this wrath of God. Interestingly, West European dynamism was not as significantly dented by this population blow as might have been imagined, and it's possible to suggest that the pluses of access to new technology may actually have outweighed the drawbacks of this level of mortality, though both factors would weigh on the European experience, not just at this point, but for many decades and even centuries thereafter. Mongol rule began to decline in the later part of the 14th century. The Mongols were unsuccessful in two efforts at invading Japan by sea And while this was not necessarily a catastrophic setback, it did suggest some clear limits to the Mongol capacity to expand further. Most clearly, the Chinese began to organize more effectively against Mongol rule and chased the Mongols out in the latter part of the 14th century, quickly establishing a new dynastic cycle within China with the advent of the Ming Dynasty, one of the dynasties that tended to crop up after a crisis period and could then enjoy, as the Ming did, many decades of subsequent success. Mongol rule in Russia ended later. The Mongols had operated in Russia as well as in China fairly tolerantly. They didn't insist on, for example, conversions away from Christianity. They levied taxes on the Russians, but they didn't interfere intensively in Russian administration. But the Russians unquestionably viewed the Mongol period as an outside tyranny. And indeed, perhaps because of previous Russian decline, the Mongol rule did not bring the economic benefits to Russia that it did to China. This was not a vibrant society under Mongol sway. But early in the 15th century, local Russian rulers, particularly around the Duchy of Moscow, local Russian rulers began to assert increasing independence from the Mongols. And by 1450, sort of ending the post-classical period in the Russian case, by 1450 began to establish an autonomous Russian area in the Moscow region, which became then the center of Russia from that time onward, somewhat eastward from the Russian centers during the post-classical period itself. The expulsion of the Mongols from China and then from Russia led to interesting subsequent reactions, both of which indicated the distaste that these peoples had felt for Mongol control, but which pointed in rather different directions. The Chinese would obviously be preoccupied not just with chasing the Mongols out, but with creating systems that might prevent their return. And the most coherent expression of this was the beginning of the dramatic reconstruction of the Great Wall of China to the form that it takes today. The Chinese wall previously had been an earthenworks wall. This wall was brick. It allowed massive patrols to operate on its surface. A huge, huge investment to seclude China from this direction of barbarian invasion. Russian reaction, partly because Russia was less protected by natural frontiers, Russian reaction was more in terms of a steady series of conquests, initially designed to push the Mongols farther and farther back, but a series that would turn into a durable Russian commitment to expansionism, a reaction in some ways rather similar to the Chinese. In both cases, you want to do something that will prevent this dreadful occupation from recurring, but which pointed specifically in quite opposite directions, defensive in the one instance, expansionist and aggressive in the other. And this obviously would enter historical channels in subsequent periods in world history as well. The end of the Mongol period for world history more generally meant a return to increasing political barriers, including just sheer brigandage. It's important to realize that when we talk glibly about interregional travel and trade, without political controls, one of the huge barriers to regular contact and one of the huge costs of the whole system was the frequency with which bandits could beset groups of travelers, particularly in overland cases, but also on the seas. Overland travel became less possible. The opportunities to use overland travel to reach between Europe and China actually receded considerably for quite a good period of time. And thus the specific facilities that the Mongol period had offered come to an end. But there are further repercussions. The Mongol period needs to be seen as something of a rebalancing among major societies in Europe and in Asia. The impact on China was considerable, but in many ways somewhat fleeting. The Chinese perhaps deepened their hostility toward outsiders. They certainly, as I've already indicated, created defensive reactions designed to prevent this from happening in the future. But the Mongols had also confirmed China's importance in world manufacturing, and the Chinese would continue to enjoy this position for many centuries thereafter. An important modification of Chinese stance, therefore, but not a fundamental disruption. The long-term Mongol impact on Russia was, as I really have already suggested, more considerable in turning the Russians from a somewhat regional people to an increasingly aggressive and expansionist people. This would be a major theme of the next period in world history and continues to be some preoccupation even today. The Mongols had an interesting impact on Japan. The Japanese, having faced two Mongol invasions and been spared, in one case because of a typhoon that destroyed the Mongol fleet, the Japanese referred to this as a divine wind, the Japanese began to think that perhaps they were not only, along with China, the pinnacle of world civilization, but perhaps they were the pinnacle of world civilization even aside from China. Because after all, the Mongols had taken China, they didn't take Japan. So a Japanese sense of isolation from superiority to much of the rest of the world and newly applying this even to relationships to China would be an interesting factor in world history in the succeeding period. Mongol impact on Western Europe was obviously decisive. The Europeans simply lucked out. I don't think there's any other way to play it. This was just one of those fortunate accidents in world history that one needs to acknowledge sometimes occur. The Europeans lucked out. The Mongols didn't invade them at all. They got a little scared. There were some borderline clashes in Hungary and elsewhere, but they did not have the cost or anxiety of direct invasion. And the fear abated fairly quickly as well. What they did get was the benefit of this century of unusually free contact with Asia, unusual opportunities to import Asian technologies. And they use this to the hilt. As indicated, the Europeans, whatever their other faults or virtues, turned out to be an excessively zealous imitating people at this point. They knew a good thing when they saw one. They knew the advantages that new kinds of weaponry could bring in a society that was highly militaristic, in which each local ruler, each local feudal monarch was interested in whatever advantage could be obtained. So the Europeans took to Chinese explosive powder exceedingly quickly and adapted it to new metallurgical techniques that allowed the manufacture of guns and cannons so that the explosive force could be more clearly directed and targeted. They would make use of printing as well in ways that would have deep implications for European culture and bureaucracy. The Europeans, in other words, clearly were the leading beneficiaries from this Mongol era, perhaps benefiting in part because of their own alertness to the possibilities of imitation. You don't want to withdraw a European attribute here, but beneficiaries also of a simple concatenation of forces that has to be termed just good luck. It would be stretching it to apply the Mongol experience to other societies, but I do want to mention one other case because we'll return to it in a session quite soon. Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, had no particular impact from the Mongol experience one way or the other. African goods did reach the Mongols. This was part of the long-distance trading patterns. So certain African animal products were used as decoration by Mongol rulers, but the African experience itself was not significantly affected. Africa continued to deal with the rest of the world mainly through the medium of Islamic traders, and these traders were largely buffered from Mongol impact. This meant that Africa was not disrupted, as some parts of the world were by the Mongol experience, but it also meant that the Africans had no particular stimulus to learn from new technological opportunities